Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this book launch event this evening. And like me, I'm sure you're pleased to be out of the horrible English weather that we're having today. It is a great pleasure to welcome three friends and three friends of the Hellenic Observatory. In fact, I've been involved in the PhDs of each of these friends in one way or another. But we're here, of course, for a book launch. And the book with Daphne Halikopoulou and Sofia Vassilopoulou is The Golden Dawn's Nationalist Solution, Explaining the Rise of the Far Right in Greece. Highly topical, looking at the Golden Dawn in Greece. Let me say something about our speakers this evening. My job is purely to be the choreographer, whilst others display their expertise. Sofia Vassilopoulou is a political scientist with a strong background in the wider fields of comparative politics and European Union politics, and party politics, and a particular interest in social research methodologies. She is currently in the Department of Politics at the University of York, and she's written extensively in these fields of specialisation. Daphne Halikopoulou is an associate professor at the University of Reading, and her work focuses on nationalism and party competition in Europe. She's particularly interested in the radical aspect of nationalism, right-wing extremism, and the politics of exclusion, topics which could hardly be more important in Europe as we speak. Orthon Anastasakis is the director of the European Studies Centre at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, director of the Southeast European Studies Programme at Oxford, and is also based at St. Anthony's College. I should, of course, make the obvious point that all three of them are alumni of the LSE, and we're very pleased to see the continued success. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Daphne and Sofia to make a presentation, and then I'm going to invite Orthon to make some comments on the book and on the presentation. In case I forget at the very end of the proceedings, let me make the announcement now that there will be a wine reception outside after this event. There are rewards, both intellectual and spiritual, for coming. And in the reception, you will be able to pick up a flyer for the book with Palgrave, looking like this. And by picking up the flyer, you will then be able to leave and buy the book using a particular code on the flyer and purchase the book at a 30% discount. So I strongly encourage you to consider doing that, whilst we give you wine and volume and security. So without further ado, it is a great pleasure to introduce each of the three speakers. Can you please welcome them from the end?
Thank you very much. Can I just say thank you very much to Kevin and the Hellenic Observatory for holding this event for us today. We are going to be alternating. We'll be talking for about 40 minutes to give you a bit of an idea what our book is about. So we'll be alternating presenting various bits of it. We worked very hard on this. We submitted this on New Year's Eve around 7 in the evening, Greek time. So we're very happy with the result. So as Kevin was saying, this book is about the ultra-nationalist, racist, extremist, what we call neo-Nazi Golden Dawn. I just want to very briefly give you a bit of a background, possibly for those of you who are not aware, of the electoral successes of this party. So this is clearly a very topical event. We had an election in Greece in January, as I'm sure you're all very aware, and everybody's been talking about the victory of the coalition of the radical left Syriza, who are now in government with the radical right, I would say, Independent Greeks. These are the electoral results. Now, beyond, obviously, the government and the rapid decline of PASOK, etc., that we can talk about at another time, what we find striking is the success of the Golden Dawn. It got 6.3% of the vote, with 17 seats currently in the Greek parliament. You might think that's not that massive and maybe a little bit of a decline from what it got in the 2014 EP elections and also in the May and June 2012 elections. However, given the fact that A, as I said, this is a racist, ultra-nationalist Nazi party, and secondly, given the fact that their leading cadres of the party are actually in prison and awaiting trial and indictment, this is a really big result. Now, what is really interesting about this party, what I've got here is the electoral success, or the electoral performance, rather, of the Golden Dawn across time. So as you'll see, it started running for elections in the mid-1990s with very, very little success. So this was essentially a grassroots movement operating in the streets, so with a lot of violence, basically. But it never enjoyed much electoral success until its breakthrough in May and June 2012, when it got 6.97% and 6.92% of the vote, respectively, winning 21 and 18 seats in Parliament. So the Golden Dawn started the breakthrough in 2012, and for many, the Golden Dawn is here to stay, despite the fact that it is currently awaiting trial. And a lot of people will say, well, you know what, we have a dramatic economic crisis, severe economic crisis in Greece. Perhaps this is not that surprising. There is the rise of the radical right is a phenomenon that we can observe across Europe. Maybe this is not that surprising. But if we look at these results comparatively, in other countries with severe economic crisis, as Sophia will tell you a bit later, there hasn't been a similar result. And also we need to understand that Greece is a country that has experienced military dictatorship in the past and also experienced the atrocities of Nazi invasion. So how is it possible, and this is the main puzzle that we are trying to answer in our book, how is it possible for a country that has gone through a junta regime, a country that has experienced Nazi dictatorship, that has experienced Nazi invasion in the 1940s, how can 400,000 Greek citizens vote for a party that clearly endorses national socialism? And that is a quote. So this is the question that we are trying to answer. And we have put forward in our book, so this is our book in a nutshell, it's our book in one single PowerPoint slide. Essentially, we have put it forward an argument that takes into account both demand and supply side dynamics. So again, as Sophia will tell you in more detail later, usually there is a demand approach, i.e. severe economic crisis will alter, or some kind of external trigger factor will alter the societal dynamics, therefore prompting people to vote for the far right. On the other side, there is the supply-side literature that says in order to understand the rise of such parties, we need to understand supply, i.e. the political context within which parties operate, or the parties themselves, the discourse that they put forward, and how they attempt to make the rhetoric more attractive to the public. We say that each of those is insufficient in explaining the Golden Dawn. So we put forward an argument that understands the interdependence of both demand and supply-side dynamics, and we use an overall framework of theories of fascism rather than theories of the radical right to explain this. So we argue that the success of the Golden Dawn is dependent on the extent to which the party was able to propound plausible solutions to three sets, not only economic, but three sets of crises, that is economic, political, and overall ideological, that culminated into a crisis of democracy and the nation state in Greece. This is the demand side. In terms of supply, the Golden Dawn put forward its nationalist solution. It was able to tap into the widespread disillusionment of the Greek people by offering them this nationalist solution. We do this by emphasizing Roger Griffin's argument of fascist movements, focusing focusing on the way that the Golden Dawn puts forward two sets of myths, two sets of fascist myths in its discourse. The myth of social decadence, i.e. society is in absolute social decay and only we can make it overcome this, and the myth of national rebirth, the nation, our nation, Greece, is like a phoenix that will rise from its ashes. But Sophia will explain this in more detail.
Thank you very much. So, yes, so now you've heard our argument. We'll try to break that down into various constituent parts because it was probably too much for just one slide. So basically, I just want to walk you through the four sections of our presentation from now on, which do speak to the point of demand and supply, as Daphne just mentioned. So I am going to start with examining the context of the Greek crisis and showing to you how this economic crisis, went really beyond the economic sphere. I will continue by examining who actually votes for the Golden Dawn. What is the socioeconomic background of people who vote for this party? What type of attitudes do these people have? And then I'm going to hand it over again back to Daphne, who will continue looking at the strategies that the rhetorical strategies or the discourse strategies that the Golden Dawn is putting forward. First, is going to look at the myth of social decadence, and then she will continue with the myth of national rebirth. So let me start with the context. Now, what we're trying to argue, and again, we're kind of borrowing from theories of fascism, is that actually the sovereign debt crisis in Greece went well beyond the economic sphere. Actually, what we are witnessing, or what we have witnessed in Greece, is an economic, political, and ideological crisis, which has culminated into a crisis of democratic representation, a crisis of the state and its democratic institutions. So a broader crisis of the state, not just an economic crisis. We know that, well, I mean, there are a variety of indicators that tell us that. I mean, first of all, there has been great levels of party system fragmentation. We saw the implosion of PASOK, a very strong party from the post-dictatorship era onwards. We saw high levels of electoral volatility, small parties rising from nothing. What we also saw is that actually the state was perceived as not able to mediate the effects of the crisis. And as a result, the people punished the parties. The parties actually lost their legitimacy. So essentially, the crisis altered political dynamics and offered the Golden Dawn increased opportunities to put forward this national solution that we will talk about in a bit. Let's look at a few indicators, starting from the economy. What we've done here is we're just giving you kind of a brief overview of the government levels of government deficit, unemployment, youth unemployment, and real GDP growth from 2009 and 2013 to 2013. What we see is that actually the deficit of Greece was one of the highest in the EU, in the EU countries, higher than Spain and Portugal. In terms of unemployment, we see that actually in 2012, when we saw the big breakthrough of the Golden Dawn, one in four people were unemployed, and actually 55% of young people, meaning under 26, were actually unemployed as well. This was accompanied by recession and obviously the bailouts and the memorandum of understanding that we all know. So this is the economic snapshot, right? The point here is that, yes, Greece was in trouble. You could compare these indicators to other countries, and you see it was in trouble both in standalone terms but also in comparison to other countries. But what we say is that we need to look at indicators beyond the economy and how people perceived governance in the country. So what we see, if we examine a variety of good governance indicators, is that actually the people perceive the state as unable to mediate the effects of the crisis. I mean, what we show you here is five indicators, which are standard good governance indicators from the World Bank, which relate to people's perception of political stability, people's perception of government effectiveness, right? people's perceptions of regulatory quality, the rule of law and the justice system, and corruption. Now, what you see, what we've tried to show you here is basically how people's perceptions on aggregate scored over 3 years, 2003, 2008, and 2013. And what we do see is that in all these five indicators, the perceptions are declining. So people actually think that the state is not able to deliver good governance. Its governance indicators are really, really low. There is no trust in the system, there is no trust in the rule of law and the justice system. People think that regulatory quality is not very good. It means that private companies cannot really operate in the country and so on. And control of corruption is deteriorating dramatically over the years.
Sophia, I just add one little footnote to that? In actual fact, the same data shows that Greece is diverging with the rest of the European Union. Yes. So this problem is not some kind of European-wide thing. It's a Greek.
Yes.
It's a Greek thing.
Yes, I think it's basically the data. I mean, I didn't want to bore you with quite a lot of graphs, but the point here is that Greece is doing badly not only in standalone terms but also in comparison to other EU member states. Right, let me just move on, and actually I have one comparative graph here that actually I want to show you how essentially these low perceptions of good governance actually have been translated into very low levels of trust in politicians, in parties, in the parliament, and generally very low levels of satisfaction with democracy in Greece. And here the blue bar is Greece, and then the red bar is Portugal and the green bar in Spain. So actually what you see is that people are more dissatisfied with democracy, even if you compare Greece to other crisis-ridden countries, such as Spain and Portugal, that are also in the news and have also suffered economic crisis. So what do I really want to show you here is that actually the economic crisis had additional components which relate to declining perceptions of good governance indicators and very low levels of trust in institutions and very low levels of satisfaction with democracy. So, so what we're seeing here is actually a political crisis, an ideological crisis, and a crisis of representation. Actually, what we saw in the electoral results is that the main parties did lose their voting base because they lost legitimacy being associated with limited state capacity. Now, what we do know is that the crisis was a big shock in the system, and this is what I just explained to you. But who actually votes for the Golden Dawn? Who are these people that opt for such an extremist party, a party that is openly neo-Nazi, that espouses violence, its members consider themselves as soldiers, right? So what we did here is we said, okay, let's have a look at demand in terms of individual level data and look at who actually votes for these people. The theory here tells you that there are two types of model that there are two types of models that explain support for such parties. The first is what we call the socio-grievance model. Basically, that model looks at objective indicators, right? So where you live, what is your gender, what is your age, what is your income, your employment status, and so on, and tries to predict, using these indicators, to predict likelihood or probability for voting for such parties. And then the second model is actually what we call political grievance, which actually goes beyond the socio-structural indicators and looks at attitudes, how people feel about democracy, how people feel about the European Union, how people feel about the government, do they approve the government, and so on. Now, what we did is we looked at the 2014 European election study data, and we ran various regression models to actually test these two theoretical models, and what we found is actually that the majority of socio-structural indicators do not really work. They do not really help us predict voting for the Golden Dawn. So in other words, if you know how old someone is, if you know whether they are employed or unemployed, if you know where they live, if they live in a rural area or in a large city, and if you know their income, you're not really able to predict whether they will vote for the Golden Dawn. What does that mean? It means that actually the party got received support from across the socioeconomic spectrum, unlike other parties in Europe where we know that, you know, it's usually men, it's usually people that are poor, you know, lower income, it's usually people that live in the cities. So actually, the Golden Dawn deviates from that model. What does matter, however, is education, and perhaps not that surprising, what we find is that people, I'll show you a little graph here, people that have lower levels of education, vocational or just finished school, are much more likely to opt for the Golden Dawn. What we also found is that left-right self-placement matters, so the more right-wing you are and the more right-wing attitudes you express, the more likely you are to vote for the Golden Dawn. We actually found that anti-Europeans or Eurosceptic people tend to vote for the Golden Dawn. People who actually disapprove of the government performance, going back to the points I made earlier, tend to vote for the Golden Dawn. People who subjectively feel that they have been worse off economically vote for the Golden Dawn. So essentially, it is attitudes that matter rather than socioeconomic objective data. So grievance, anxiousness, bewilderment, insecurity, and resentfulness. So really the point there is whether people are becoming cynical and against the government, and they are becoming resentful and insecure rather than specific socioeconomic characteristics. So I already talked about education. Just the last graph, actually, which is very interesting, is that what we found is that dissatisfaction in and by itself doesn't matter. And I think, you know, it's probably something that you're thinking already, because the majority of Greeks are dissatisfied at the moment, right? We have left-wing dissatisfied and right-wing dissatisfied. But actually what we saw is that if you interact satisfaction with the left-right, where people stand on the left-right dimension, then you do see an effect. What does that mean? If you are dissatisfied and right-wing, you're very likely to vote for the Golden Dawn. And obviously, if you are dissatisfied and left-wing, you probably may opt for different types of parties that are not the topic of today's talk. So just to wrap up, we have severe economic crisis that went well beyond the economic sphere, went to the political sphere, and became culminated into a crisis of democratic representation. And we have people in line with this argument who vote for the Golden Dawn because they want to express a disillusionment kind of attitude rather than people who are poor and so on. So, having kind of covered here the demand side of the Golden Dawn, we're going to move on and talk about the supply side of the Golden Dawn, what actually the party did in order to capture those votes, and Daphne will talk to you about the nationalist solution. And we'll swap again.
Indeed. Right. So if we can take two things in summary of what Sophia was saying. You've basically gathered by now, our book is about the Golden Dawn in particular and about Greece in particular, but we do have a comparative rationale, and this is what has pushed us towards our argument from both demand and supply. In terms of demand, comparatively, Greece differs from the other countries that are facing severe economic crisis, such as Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, precisely because the crisis was of more of a crisis of democracy and the nation state. Now, in terms of supply, the Golden Dawn is also a comparative puzzle. Now, if you look at theories that try to explain the far right more broadly, you won't find one that tells you that a fascist or neo-Nazi party is likely to gain any electoral success after the Second World War. So basically, all theories predict that the parties that are on the far right side, on the far right scale, that will experience a rise in their support are those that distance themselves from fascism and that try to disassociate themselves from their fascist past. So you either get sort of the radical right parties such as the Dutch PVV or the Swiss SVP that are basically don't employ violence and use a more civic rhetoric in their narrative, or you get parties like the Front National, with Marine Le Pen now trying to distance the party from the old type of fascism. Yet in Greece, you have this neo-Nazi party. This is a puzzle in itself, and we argue that in order to understand why a party with such type of rhetoric, so looking at that supply, why it's been able to rise, we should do so through theories of fascism rather than through theories of, more broadly speaking, the radical right. So what we've done here in terms of context is we've looked at Michael Mann's theory, understanding fascism as comprising the following principles: nation-statism, paramilitarism, transcendence, and cleansing. In other words, for those of you not as familiar with Michael Mann's theory, basically it is a party, the Golden Dawn is a party, that is nation-statist, as it wants a massive, a really big, powerful state, which is sort of the embodiment of the nation, to be supreme. It wants to do that, it seeks to do that through paramilitary means, so it has a very strong sort of military presence. It's, as Sophia was saying, Golden Dawn members look like they think they are soldiers, street soldiers. They actually, they've been training in camps, they have very close links with the police and the army. They seek what Michael Mann calls transcendence, which is the idea that society is in decay and needs to be transcended onto a next level of social order, which will be done through this organization that the Golden Dawn is like. And cleansing, well, transcendence into a different social level can only take place through the cleansing of those elements that make our society, have put our society into decay. This refers to two sets of enemies, internal enemies. These are essentially the communists or any other forces that are not of the right wing, and external enemies, which are the immigrants. So in other words, like a classic fascist movement, the Golden Dawn emphasizes a very strong state that is embodied by the nation. It seeks paramilitary means of making this state more powerful. It wants to transcend into a different social order where this organization will be supreme, and in doing so, it wishes to cleanse the nation from all external and internal enemies. This is the narrative that it actually puts forward, and we have termed this the Golden Dawn's nationalist solution, and here we draw from Roger Griffin's concept of twin fascist myths. So we say that it seeks to achieve its aims through putting forward in its discourse the two twin fascist myths, the myth of social decadence and the myth of palingenesis, or the myth of national rebirth. Now, we had a lot of fun working on that section of the book because we read hundreds of online Golden Dawn materials, which come under these headings. So current, they have... So if I don't know if anyone has that interest, and for those of you who are Greek, mostly if you've been on the Golden Dawn's website, but if you do speak Greek, I do encourage you, even for entertainment, to go on. They have an extremely elaborate website. In fact, I was on it very recently, and I'm not very proud of that. But anyway, they have a very elaborate website, and they have many sections on that website where they try to put their ideas forward. So they take a lot of care to post things all the time. They have the following section: current affairs, which is coverage of the news from their own perspective, ideological texts, which is sort of more blog-like ideological positions or thesis that they put forward, and history and civilization, which is where they essentially have dedication pages to Greek people, not Greek fascist only, I mean, Metaxas features prominently, but actually any Greek famous artist, poet, politician, ancient Greek, that they sort of appropriate as their own, as we will see. So we had a lot of fun analysing these in depth, putting them within this framework. So how does the Golden Dawn does that? So A, the myth of social decadence. So basically their entire discourse is premised on the idea that Greek society is undergoing rapid and deep societal decay. So our society is in decay, but this is not the fault of the Greek people. This is the fault of the Greek leaders, the Greek politicians, those that have led the country in the past years, and also their external collaborators that also seek to undermine Greece. Now, we argue that this is what constitutes what forms Greece's populist nation-statism, i.e. the fascist concept. So first, the Golden Dawn presents itself as a movement from below. And this is how it differs from authoritarian movements, from the junta regime, or from other authoritarian movements that are elite-led. So although there is a very strong elitist element in the Golden Dawn, actually what they're trying to say is that we don't want to lead the country, we embody the country. We don't want to lead the nation, we are the embodiment of the nation. Therefore, like fascist movements, we are a movement from below. We are a movement instigated by the people, we are the people, hence the populism part. We are the people, and our leader is not the leader of the nation, is the embodiment, the very embodiment of the nation. So in fact, they put forward a totalitarian type of rhetoric. We are the nation, we are the people. Then, but we have a problem. You know, our nation and our people are actually in this terrible situation of decadence, and we need to transcend that, and in order to transcend it, we must cleanse our nation. And how will we cleanse our nation? They have very, very long sections on communism and anti-Semitism, actually, which they merge, interestingly. And we need to also cleanse from external enemies, so immigrants are there to undermine our nation, and they also do this through propaganda and violence. I will show you. So, for example, and this is another way, Golden Dawn's populist nation-statism, another way of seeing them as a fascist movement. This is the Golden Dawn's way of appropriating welfare. So they actually put forward an alternative means of welfare provision. This is their, it says, for those of you who can't read Greek, it's Greek doctors. It is prominent on their website. This is their attempt to offer health provision for those Greeks who, in the current crisis system, can't afford it. So this is their nation statism. We are trying to put forward a different way of providing at an organized level for Greek people. This, needless to say, is only for Greeks. You have to produce your Greek identity card in order to have that. And also coincides with other initiatives that they have done, such as organizing soup kitchens or food provision for, again, only Greeks, only to be granted with the provision of an identity card. I believe that this is something that the Nazis did as well. It's called, I don't remember the German name, but it's also something that the Nazi Party did. Now, this, just for fun, this is from the Golden Dawn's website. It's a bit of a pun on Syriza. So this is our Prime Minister Tsipras. And the logo of the Coalition of the Radical Left for the electoral campaign was "Hope is coming." So this is the Golden Dawn's kind of pun. It encompasses how they feel about both internal and external enemies. So no, there isn't really any hope, because the left, combined with those criminal immigrants, are actually going to bring the country into further decay. And their website is replete with these images. And then again, propaganda and violence. You might be a bit fearful of this, but this is actually what they look like. And if you are in Athens, and if you are lucky, you might see a group of them just walking around the streets with clubs covered with the Greek flag. So this is actually, they do actually, they've been involved in a number of violent activities, grievous bodily harm, even murder, which is why the initiative to imprison them commenced from the 1990s, but again, even now that they've been in government, they've been involved in a series of violent activities. So, to briefly recap, society is in terrible decay, and we need our movement to solve that. How will we do this? Well, our nation will be reborn through us. So I've got here another interesting, again, for those of you who don't speak Greek, this says, so this is Greece reborn, right? The lady is actually Greece, with the Meander flag, which is a type of Nazi, but not really, they say. And it says, here it says, Greece is meant to live and it will live. So Greece is constantly under threat. The solution to this problem that we are facing is a phoenix-like national rebirth from the ashes of the degenerate social order. We call this the Golden Dawn's populist ultra-nationalism. So in order to clarify our argument of that, on that, we have used here a combination of Michael Mann, as we said, Roger Griffin, and also Anthony Smith and his myth of social, of chosenness and ethnic election. So essentially what the Golden Dawn is putting forward, and quite blatantly in the rhetoric, is that the Greek nation will be reborn through this populist purifying trans class movement. And again, they draw on this. So as Sophia showed you with the data, like the support for fascism in the interwar period, Greek Golden Dawn support comes from all over the place. So that makes it easier for them to present themselves as a trans-class movement. We don't particularly capture one social class, we capture everyone because we are all the people. Everyone is the people that want to transcend the social order. And this, the nation, which is something that is quite resonant in Greece more generally, is the way that they try to justify the fact that they are a statist, paramilitarist, cleansing type of organization. And they do so by showing that the Greek nation is a nation that is chosen. Right? So, for example, using Smith's framework, we've shown that the Golden Dawn, it is replete in their materials. What is replete in the materials is a constant reinforcement of a strict boundary between the ethnic community and the other. So it is constantly represented that the other is not only alien, the other is not only our enemy, but the other is also inferior. So point number two, there is a sense of moral superiority. They draw on a number of Greek myths and a number of Greek historical battles, wars, whatever you can think of, to show this. So Leonidas features very prominently, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, but also all the people who fought in the Greek War of Independence feature very, very prominently. We were, and what is underpinning this is we were great in the past and we will be great again. We were great, we had a golden age, there's a bit of a decay now, but we're going to overcome this and we will be great again. There is also this element of this doctrine of spiritual liberation that emphasizes the community's special destiny. So Greeks are destined to be great. They are a community chosen by God to be great. It is something that we have by birth. It is something that has been endowed to the Greek nation by virtue of biology. It is not something that we have achieved throughout the years. We were born with it. And if you are born Greek, you are immediately superior and great. And there is also this idea of the necessity of an elite-driven mobilization, which, as I said, takes, however, the form of a fascist movement in that it is elite-driven, in that the Golden Dawn will drive it, will lead it at first, but then they will be the embodiment of the people, so not like the elitist authoritarian movements of the past. So just to conclude, so very briefly, we have had a very, very a loose comparative rationale underlying our argument. There's something different happening in Greece. We put forward a different way of trying to understand it. And we've basically shown that the rise of the Golden Dawn is a product of the interdependence of demand-side dynamics, i.e. an overall crisis of the nation-state, with supply-side dynamics, i.e. the use of fascist myths to put forward a narrative that will apply across various social groups. Now, this is very important, we think, for a number of reasons, and it's also given us quite a lot of thought to start different projects, more other new projects on the impact of the Golden Dawn. So we're currently working on a Hellenic Observatory-funded project to see, actually, the policy implications that this has, not only in terms of the rise of the Golden Dawn per se, but also the effect the Golden Dawn has on the rest of the party system and in various different policy areas. So, for example, immigration. The rise of the Golden Dawn has meant that other parties that are not on the far-right scale might also seek, or do actually also seek, to strengthen anti-immigrant policies in order to capture potential Golden Dawn voters. So party competition, there is a possibility, has been moving immigration to more to the right. Foreign policy is another one, and the fact that independent Greeks is also in government, so you're seeing that radical right ideas and far-right ideas might also be capturing the foreign policy realm, which could be a problem, a practical problem, even if the Golden Dawn don't, it's not only a question of, you know, how, is the Golden Dawn support going to even increase? It's not even a question of that. And again, just to conclude, multiculturalism and minority rights. So there have been many, there are many ongoing issues in Greece about how we treat minorities in a country that is quite homogenous. And this is a significant. There was Operation Xenios Dias, and so many other policies that I don't have time to talk about. So we are working at the moment on sort of moving the ideas from the book forward to see not only to what extent the Golden Dawn has in itself a big impact on Greek society, but also the extent to which its rise impacts on the party system, on the ideologies of different parties, and the way that policies are upheld and implemented in Greece. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sophia, and thank you, Daphne. We're very pleased to have Othon to give us his comments.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and it's great to be here. Now, I first have to say that I enjoyed very much reading this. Pivot makes his publications electronic mostly, but I'm still on hard copies, and I need you to sign it for me afterwards. I enjoyed reading it, and there's a lot of information, and I recommend it. That's my first point. My second is that I also have to congratulate you because you went through all these documents, which I can understand only. They're so boring.
And, no.
And it's like you have to read all this nonsense in a kind of very serious academic way and engage with it. And possibly Kevin remembers that because I had the pleasure of having Kevin as my external examiner, and that was one of the most pleasant experiences of my life, Kevin. In my thesis that was about dictatorships, part of it was about fascist regimes. I had to go, and it was about ideology of these regimes, right? And I had to go through all these documents of the fascist regimes and then the military dictatorships as well. And I can understand, you know, how one feels when reading all this nonsense. Now, this is a very well-structured book, and you give us a lot of information. And it's also very tidy because there's a theoretical discussion at the beginning. There is a methodological part, which is about the supply-demand. And then there's your empirical work in terms of who votes for the Golden Dawn. And then, obviously, your last question, which is why, you know, these people end up voting. And in the true LSE and Oxford tradition, I will be critical with constructive criticism because there's a food for thought here, and obviously, you know, the topic is something which is itself is very provocative. Now, my first comment would go then to your, you know, initial question, your terminology, and what do you consider success? Because 6% in two elections and the 9% in the European elections, can we consider this a success or something natural in such a disastrous economic and political environment? Is it a worrying phenomenon? I mean, do we have to worry? What is the percentage that we should start worrying? That's something I think that we need to have to think, because others would say that, you know, this is nothing, you know, so serious. It's a 6%. It's, you know, it's all kind of natural. And by the way, it's going to last for as long as this crisis lasts. One interesting question also, I think, with the Golden Dawn, but also with other European cases, is to look at why there is a 6% in the national elections and a 9% in the European elections. That means that people in European elections, when they vote for those extreme parties, they have different considerations in their mind, because this is what we're seeing in other countries, so Greece is not unique in that you've got this higher percentage in the European. Now, that's my first point. My second point is your methodology, and you kind of combine the supply and demand, and at the same time, the political versus economic explanations, and that I find very useful in kind of structuring the argument. Now, the demand side is what I would say here is an environment which is not specific only to Golden Dawn, is to the rise of other parties as well. So it's the more general environment in a way. So by itself, it cannot explain exactly why we have the rise of a far-right party. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, the system is delegitimized. The two-party system has gone to the garbage. You've got the rise of other parties. So, you know, in a way, the demand in itself is something that, that cannot explain as much. Then the supply side is something where I would like to discuss a little bit, because this is where I had the biggest problem in terms of the supply of this nationalist ideology as the pull factor for these people to vote for Golden Dawn. And by the way, I found that your analysis on the voters is very, very useful, because at the end of the day, this is what we need to know, right? Who votes for these parties, why? And obviously the outcome is inconclusive because you don't have too many elections in order to be able to have a better understanding. In France, for instance, with the Front National, or in Austria, in countries that have a bigger tradition of far-right parties, there is, is much more clear who votes and why. So in our case, everything has to be tentative, so that's why you don't reach conclusions. So let me go then to the nationalist ideology that you were identifying, because to my mind, I find this a little bit static, because I believe two things. The first one, that radical parties, they do change their discourse, they change their presence, and they themselves do adapt to different circumstances, because they are parties and they need to win elections, and that's how they need to understand what's over there in order to be able to associate with it. So by simply focusing on this nationalist rhetoric, we're not able to understand why the party will go up or down, or why at the end of the day it will attract these voters. So this is where I had the biggest kind of problem as And the second thing that I think is very true for the far-right parties is that it's not just about nationalist ideology and the rebirth of the nation. It's also a grouping, a constellation of different rhetorics and themes that they use. I mean, that's a characteristic of most radical parties of the extreme right in Europe. They use a little bit of the economic argument. They use a little bit of the political. They often target corruption, and that was a very fertile ground in the Greek case. They also talk a lot about immigration, and in that way, then you can engage with those different audiences, those electoral audiences. So that, for me, is something, the ideology that they offer, or the rhetoric, rather, because, you know, it's not exactly an ideological framework that they offer, and it's not consistent at all. But there are little themes, and they try to kind of get on the immigration. I mean, they try to generate the climate of fear, aversion, and danger. The fear is, you know, for the future of the economy, what's going to happen. So there is a target there that, you know, that relates to that. Then there is an anger for the corruption. I remember in this conference that we organized in Oxford, and we shared the panel, that there were some social anthropologists that, you know, their point was exactly that, that the issue of corruption was very, very prominent in some of those who were voted for the far right. And then there is also the issue of immigration. I mean, that's another point that they... So that is what I really missed, how these kind of different themes engage with this nationalist rhetoric. And in the end, you know, they managed to kind of get them to, you know, to vote for this kind of political alternatives. One other point that I would like to add here is that I believe that the Golden Dawn should be seen in two ways. One is as part of the far-right political families, you know, in Europe. So they have certain characteristics. They're ultra-nationalist. They're Eurosceptic. They are against immigration. They are racist. Some of them are, you know, are also with Nazi references. And that, I suppose, part of it, being part of the political family, is what explains also the resilience of these parties, because these are the kind of the the themes that keep on coming up on and on. And then the second way to see the Golden Dawn is also part of the anti-memorandum family in Greece, because it's not exactly that it is the exceptional party over there that is completely different and distanced from the rest. It's part of a polarization of a country which is, since the start of the crisis, it's been divided between the memorandum, anti-memorandum, or the austerity and anti-austerity. And that has been the case with Greece. And the Golden Dawn is clearly on the side of the anti-austerity parties and the anti-memorandum. So it does share certain characteristics with all these parties. And that, for me, is very interesting, because then the question comes is, why does the Golden Dawn get 6% and then Syriza gets a 36%? Because if you want to see the most dramatic rise of a party, it's not the Golden Dawn, it's actually Syriza. And how it relates then to the other parties, for me, is something very important. Then you do touch on your book and also in your presentation, that for me is also something which is important, is, you know, whether we're talking of a Greek exceptionalism. I have been working on the comparative understanding of the extreme right parties in the European elections of 2014. And I've tried to see, you know, how the outcomes, the results, the electoral results, they relate to economic growth, to unemployment, to austerity, and to the issue of immigration, the big themes that really were tormenting the Eurozone. And one finds that Western Europe is where you find the radical parties. The better of countries, actually, are the ones that are done. So, you know, and then you've got a more volatile environment in Eastern Europe, and you don't have any rise, parties in Southern Europe. So are we talking of a Greek exceptionalism here, that we cannot fit Greece neither in the Western advanced case, because it's, you know, it was the one that suffered, nor in the Southern European case, because there are similar characteristics in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and Cyprus, because they all suffered from their own sovereignty was curtailed because of the bailouts and all this, but still you don't see far-right parties there. And that, for me, is a question as to whether we're dealing with, yet again, Greek exceptionalism, because all that happened in Greece's economic crisis was so, so dramatic. Although one might say, and using also your argument on the on this nationalist ideology, maybe there are some parallels here with Jobbik. And that, I think, it may be a worthy comparison, because similarly, Hungary is a country that hasn't solved its own nationalist question. There are Hungarians all around the Hungary's borders. It never actually dealt with its own past since the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And similarly, it has an affinity towards neo-Nazi symbols and also this paramilitary, that combination of parliamentary and extra-parliamentary paramilitary activity. Although it has to be said, I will finish with that, which is how I started also, is that I strongly believe that these parties are also changing. They're adapting to the circumstances. First of all, violence in Greece, the series of the Golden Dawn violence in Greece has subsided the last few. I mean, it has kind of diminished.
Because they're locked up. That helps.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, there is a change. And also, if you go to the Jobbik example, they are now, which is the alternative now to Fidesz. I mean, Hungary is the very interesting example of a country that has a nationalist government and the far-right party, which is the next alternative, because social democracy is non-existent there. So Jobbik now is trying, and has already started, to target the center. So these parties as well, they're not just those parties of the extreme, that they are changing themselves, and we are seeing this in all the other parties of, I mean, you know, Marine Le Pen is at odds with her own dad now because of this kind of distancing that they want to do. So that, I think, is something that needs to be taken into consideration. And that was my main problem, is that I thought that by looking at this nationalism, the rebirth, and using the fascist kind of model in order to be able to understand why they become the pull factor, it may become a little bit static, but also it doesn't allow us to understand all that is dynamic and is changing within parties, but also the ones that are voting for them. These are my points.
Thank you, Autumn, very much indeed. With Daphne and Sophia's approval, can I open it up to the audience and then you come back? So I'm sure hands are going straight up in the usual fashion. Could we take the gentleman here, please, in the middle? And can we take three questions at a time?
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Hello.
Could you just say who you are?
My name is Trifonas, and I'm coming often, you know, to attend all these lectures. Very interesting stuff. Thank you. I have a question about this spread of greatness and about the purity of our nation. Don't you think that there is responsibility, in extent, to our educational system, plus that there were some ideological parties or political parties active in the 1980s, beginning of 2000, where we're spreading, you know, the importance of the language, the importance of our history, like the group of New Orthodox of Mr. Yanaras and Zouraris. Thank you.
Thank you. More questions? Bernard here.
Bernard Casey from Hellenic Observatory and other places. Thank you, all of you. That was very good. I was struck by the analogy with Jobbik as it was going along, so I was glad that Autumn picked that up. I know a bit more, perhaps, about that part of the world than I do about other parts, so I think that analogy is good. But the other thing which I was also struck by was the discussion which came up about who are the people who might be supporting, and the reference to the anxious, bewildered, insecure, because, again, if one looks at the German 1930s experience, that is exactly what one sees. So I think there is a lot of mileage in that. The other thing, however, which I also see is something much closer to home, which is the UKIP party here, and exactly the same group of people who are being swept up in that. I mean, the difference is that these people don't have the militaristic dimension which Jobbik or Golden Dawn does. So it comes really to, I suppose, again, Orthon's final question. I mean, are there tipping points, and do these things become something more? And to some extent, you answered that yourself, Autumn, when you pointed to the Jobbik experience, because here now, I mean, there is a party which is sheltering behind Fidesz. Fidesz is adapting to it. But if you point again to what's going on in France and French parties, the list of things which you put on your final slide about where policy is being introduced, what's happening there, you look at the UK, what is happening there, and the concessions which, you know, sort of post-election, one is well aware that the current government might have been making on a whole lot of those issues which are listed there. So I think, you know, that is an important question. 6% doesn't look much. People used to laugh at Adolf Hitler and some funny people in beer halls in Munich.
Thank you. Can we go to the gentleman right at the very back, please?
Thank you. My name is Georgos Kallis. I'm a visiting professor at SOAS, and I wanted to ask you more for the grassroots action of Golden Dawn, with the example, for example, that you gave about the clinics, the Greek clinics. So I wanted to ask how serious is that? How big is it? Not only the clinics, but also the food deliveries, etc. Or how much is it geared towards mediatic attention? So getting attention from the mass media and giving the impression that they are doing something at the grassroots level or not. And I'm interested because I'm interested more into the solidarity economy that it's working and growing up in Greece. And it's coming more from a left or autonomist tradition. So I wanted to get a sense of how does it compare to that. So how big are these clinics compared to, let's say, the alternative health clinics that exist in Athens. So,
good, thank you. I'm afraid you've been bombarded by questions and
so
issues. Do you want to respond to
possibly these questions and then come back to Orthons at the end, entirely as you wish.
I think some of the questions sort of are mixed, so I'm going to answer some of the questions by also picking up on some of the things you said. What do I have here? Education system, yes, absolutely, and very much so. And in fact, well, I've done an analysis of the education system for a different thing, for my PhD, actually, and it is, I think, the basic idea is that nationalism is so prominent in Greece, which is why we're talking about the interdependence of demand and supply, so precisely because these ideas are widespread. It is not a radical thing to say we are nationalists. It is not a radical thing to talk about the nation, which is a problem. And it's not surprising that educational reform is not going through. So whether you want to try and instigate reform from the left or from the right or from the center, when it comes to school textbooks, oh no. No, we keep them. So it's a huge problem. I completely completely agree with you. Now, your UKIP point, I want to link with your point about whether the Golden Dawn is part of the far-right party family, which I think is an important point that underlines the book. Now, what we've done in the book is we've argued that there is an overarching umbrella term that is the far-right, and under that comes the extreme right and then the radical right. Now, these, you can argue, most certainly differ in terms of degree. Right, so the extreme right is far more violent. The extreme right is far more on the fringes of the party system. The extreme right, if you like, adopts a more biological type of rhetoric. So is it surprising that, say, in the UK that we have the same social base? It is UKIP and not the BNP, not the extreme and sometimes violent BNP that has gained support. But on the other hand, you can also see them as different in kind, as in the extent to which they support democracy. Now, the radical right-wing parties of Europe operate within the confines of parliamentary democracy, whereas the Golden Dawn is a party that has said itself, that Michail Aliakos, the leader, has said himself that he would seek to abolish parliamentary democracy. And they don't do that loosely. They do it within the fascist framework that we exactly have shown. So we're going to abolish democracy not because we don't like it, but precisely because we are a movement from below that embodies the nation like National Socialism, and we therefore must abolish the system that we have. So I think there is a fundamental difference here between those types of parties. Pardon? Precisely. Do you want to do the rest or pick up?
I'm just going to pick up on a couple of points about how do you define success? Well, given that I'm probably taking kind of the second viewpoint that there is a difference in kind as well, then 6%, it is quite a lot because you don't know what will happen in the future. And especially given that the party has been persistent in the past few years, even though in January 2015, the leader and the major cadres were in prison, the party still did really well with practically no campaign, then I would say that this is quite successful for a small party that operated in the fringes. Many years they didn't even have candidates. Sometimes they are allied with other far-right groupuscules. So they are. It's a great success for where they are coming from, kind of thing, with regard to their past. And the second point I want to make is about this kind of point about supply and demand, and then demand in itself is not enough to explain, and supply in itself is not enough to explain. If we view each of them comparatively, you see other European countries where we have ripe demand conditions. In South Europe, for example, we haven't seen a party such as the Golden Dawn or a similar party being very successful, but also supply. We have to actually see that in comparison, because one could compare a very similar supply national solution that you see in Cyprus, but actually this has not really worked. So that's why we felt that if you actually see Greece as a unique case, you don't really make an argument. You can only make an argument if you see Greece and all these indicators and all these methodological points comparatively, then you can make an argument about what's happening in the case of the rise of the Golden Dawn in Greece.
May I add something?
Yes, we'll come back.
Can I just add something to that? We're not measuring success in terms of absolute numbers, we're measuring it in terms of trends. So what is important in what we see the Golden Dawn support is 6% in itself says nothing. 6% in itself, comparatively in time, says a lot. Says a lot because 400,000 Greek people voted for that party, and in the past they didn't. Says a lot because the rest of the party system is moving towards the right. So it is a trend. Trends tell you more than absolute numbers do. And lastly, on your Greek exceptionalist question, which I also think is interesting, I don't know if we're putting forward an argument of Greece exceptionalism. What we are saying is Greece most certainly represents one of a universe of cases. So we do have an argument that could be generalizable in theory. When you have a crisis, like you had in an interwar Europe, so when you have a crisis that beyond economic is also ideological and political, culminating in a broader crisis of the nation state, and you have a group, an organization that puts forward a rhetoric that taps into that in that way, then you will have the rise of the party like the Golden Dawn. We've analyzed Greece, but that is a falsifiable theory that you could perhaps apply on another case that is exhibiting the same demand and supply side conditions to see whether it fulfills them.
Okay. Ozan, you wanted to come back.
Yes, I wanted, because I still cannot see. I mean, you know, you've done all this work with who are the supporters and what are their social, educational, or other characteristics, and what you come up here is that. The outcome is inconclusive because obviously you cannot have the elections are very few. But what you say is that most of them want something anti-systemic, so they react to the system. Now, what I fail to see is how do you prove that those who vote for the Golden Dawn are actually the ones that are the recipient of this nationalist solution? This is where I cannot see. I mean, you have to prove this somehow, that when they ask for this anti-system, that the response to them that comes from is that exactly the one that they want and they vote for this party. Because the national solution is not something that comes only from the Golden Dawn, by the way. It's something that comes from Syriza as well. I mean, that is also a party that is advocating a national solution of a different kind. So this is where I kind of fail to see the connections between your groups, and then how do you prove
that?
Absolutely. Just briefly.
Well, the only thing I would say is that this is why actually what matters in statistical models is that these people are right-wing. So this nationalist solution that the Golden Dawn is putting forward is only, the recipients of it are only right-wing people, not left-wing people. The nationalist solution of Syriza is a different type of solution. It has different types of arguments, and it becomes more successful among left-wing people.
So are they the voters of Laos then? Are they the voters of Laos? Because you don't mention Laos too much in there. That would make sense if, you know...
They are partly a new democracy. Some of them are left-wing as well, but with right-wing authoritarian views, and that's the problem. This is something that's quite confused in Greece. You may have left-wing voters who think that they're left-wing, but actually, in terms of their position on the authoritarianism scale, they're actually quite right-wing. So when we're talking about right-wing and left-wing here, we talk about, in terms of their attitudes on nationalism and authoritarianism rather than the economy per se.
And I mean, we are putting forward a non-determinant. I mean, this is a probabilistic way of saying, so within this type of crisis, you have a particular type who are more likely, and you have a particular supply offering that will more likely attract certain people. It's all you can do.
Okay, let's move on. But there was the gentleman's question at the back about grassroots action and food lines.
How effective they are.
How significant?
Well, in terms of their scale, there is quite a bit. There has been quite a bit. Now, we don't really know how significant they are, because you may actually have one or two, and then you have the media there, right? Mm. But I think the significance is not substantive in the sense of what they provide. It's substantive in the sense of how they are portrayed in the news. I mean, as an anecdotal story here about this old lady that someone stole her bag, and a Golden Dawn supporter came to the rescue, and so on, and that was on the news. And there is the other side of the story, which is apparently this was a mother of a Golden Dawn supporter. We don't know, right? But the point is, it's not the substantive point. The point is what happens in the media and how people view that.
Okay. Let's open it up again to other questions. Gentleman in the middle here, in the blue.
Yomata, TSNTHE. The question I'd actually have is related to Daphne's point on the rise of nationalism expressed through the fascism fury. I still wonder if it is actually a question of fascism per se and if Greece is unique in itself. I wonder if the rise of the Golden Dawn is important is because there wasn't any other similar party until technically quite recently with the independent Greeks to fill that gap. So in a sense, the same as BNP was quite powerful in Britain, and BNP demised to almost nothing after they've actually won an entire council a few years back, and to nothing now because the UKIP kind of took and more put the similar ideas towards the centre of the nationalist fury, and it kind of destroyed the BNP as a true party. And in Greece, you maybe didn't find that alternative yet, and you don't have enough years to have covered that. But the nationalist fury is important, I think, whereas the debate between left and right is maybe less relevant, because if you think about it, what happens in Eastern Europe with kind of the rise of very nationalist ideas in Russia, Ukraine, to a degree even Romania around 2002, I believe, in the elections where you did have an anti-Semitic government who more or less were the second in the presidential election, and a huge rise again because of austerity, because of economic failures in the country. So the rise of nationalism may be more important in so many ways into attracting the audience to play, but the time when those parties do get into power, they do tend to get a bit more centre, in which case the whole concept of fascism in the modern world may not be as strong.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions, please? Gentlemen here.
Thank you. Manolis Galinianos from Royal Holloway. you mentioned on the demand side for the rise of the Golden Dawn that there were three crises: economic, political, and ideological. So I wanted to ask you again, in a comparative mindset, what are the characteristics that turn an economic crisis, which seemed to be the source of all three of them, the way you described it, into additionally a political and ideological crisis? So again, comparing Greece to, let's say, Portugal and Spain, is the difference that the economic crisis in Greece was much more severe than those countries, and austerity much more severe, or were there other institutional features of Greece that, in its political habits, that allowed for the rise of such an extreme party?
Okay, good. Thanks. Other questions? Gentleman right at the back, please.
Yeah, Vangelis. Yeah, in relation to history, I mean, you keep on referring to Hitler, but I mean, Hitler was funded by German big business because of the Versailles Treaty. Is Golden Dawn funded by Greek big business? And there's a possibility if Golden Dawn comes to power, they're going to invade all the neighbouring countries. I mean, that's one part of the question. The second part is I'm pretty much confused how they are labelled ultra-nationalist when they have candidates in the European elections. They also support the euro. They do not want a return to the drachma. And the media emphasise them. I mean, I look at them and they just look like a bunch of clowns. I mean, all of them.
Okay, thank you. And the gentleman here, please. In the very centre with the laptop.
Do Golden Dawn have any strategies how to...
Tell us who you are.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Matt, I'm a former student here. Do Golden Dawn have any strategies how to pursue international political cooperation, for example, in the European Parliament? Or do you think European coalition building just isn't seen as a priority for them, either because they're domestically focused or because they're too extreme for the other far-right parties in the Parliament?
Okay, good. There were lots of hands going up. Can we just take this last question here, then, please?
Thanks. Bill Kassan, LSE. I'd like to ask Sophia and also the commentator, Othon. I mean, how do we place this particular story in terms of the kind of widespread fragmentation of party systems across Europe? I mean, have the last 4 years just accelerated something that was there anyway in Greece, or has it created this fragmentation? Because if you look at this country, despite the recent election result, this fragmentation goes back about 30 or 40 years.
Okay, good, thanks. Again, quite a range of questions. Do you want to start off, and then I want to bring Orphan back in as well.
Okay, you can start in this time. Huh?
Yes, okay. Right, let me just gather my thoughts. What makes an economic crisis into a political and ideological crisis is not just economy, it's not that the magnitude of the economy is different in Greece to that much, right? What we need to consider is what's happening within the country and the political system that was there before. So Greece is a country with limited state capacity. It was always a country with limited state capacity, which actually was brought to the forefront as a result of the crisis. And because of the clientelism that that permeates the Greek system, what we saw is that the failure of the state to mitigate the effects of the crisis was associated with a delegitimization of the main parties. So which actually links me to the last point that Bill made about fragmentation in Greece. Actually, fragmentation in Greece is actually a very new thing. It's extremely new. It happened from, in the last 5 years onwards. Before that, you had two main parties alternating power, together having about 85% of the seats. So this, as a phenomenon in Greece, the fragmentation is new. Broadly speaking, outside Greece, what you see in the past few years is not fragmentation of the political system, it's more of the implosion of the socialism. That's how I view it, but we can talk about that over a drink if you want. A last point about the EU and strategy for cooperation. It's difficult to do anything abroad for the Golden Dawn for two reasons. One is a lot of parties, even far-right-wing parties, consider them too extreme. And the other thing is that even if they want to cooperate, this is a classic problem of far-right-wing parties, because they define themselves, their nationalism is defined against other people's nationalism. So it's really hard to cooperate with a party because they clash, essentially. What has happened with the Golden Dawn is they have been involved in discussions with the BNP. But we've seen a few things in the media, nothing beyond that. And in terms of the EU, the point on the EU, now, the Golden Dawn has been very careful on the EU. They are criticizing the EU dramatically, but they have not said explicitly they want to leave. However, a closer look of their documents would reveal that actually the system that they are putting forward, it goes against any fundamental value of the EU that by definition they cannot stay in. But because a lot of Greek people, the majority of Greek people, are pro the euro for potentially instrumental reasons rather than ideological, they have avoided talking about that. But the system, the way we... the system they put forward, the way we explain that as a national solution, is antithetical with everything the EU puts forward.
Exactly.
Daphne, do you want to add anything?
I just wanted then to address Jon's point on, just very quickly, we're actually not saying it's the rise of nationalism. We're actually saying that what this party is doing is able to tap into already existing, hence this gentleman's point there about the education system. So nationalism is prominent, and they tap into it in a way as to extremize it, but we're not saying it's the rise of nationalism. Now, in fact, when you said there isn't such a party, hasn't been, there has. Not as extreme, so we're back to extreme radical. There has been Laos. New Democracy itself, after the dictatorship, contained many far-right wing elements. So the New Democracy Party has many elements that used to previously be known with known links to the far-right, who then some of them split. And there are many other far-right factions that actually did win electoral representation at times. Just nothing as extreme and nothing as static. So if you look at the dynamics of party competition, in that way, Greece doesn't differ that much from, say, Spain, that many parts of the Partido Popular incorporates many of the far-right elements that you have there that will at some point break into different factions. So it's not the rise.
Thanks very much. Last word to Orphan.
If I can just take up from Daphne's last point, because it is important to understand, and I agree there, the far-right nationalist discourse in the context of an already environment which accepts these kinds of historical interpretations, right? So when they excessively speak about the national myths or the ancient, that's already something which is there in the, you know, in the books. That obviously creates a paradox with other countries, like in Western Europe, where education is different. You don't have that kind of nationalist discourse in the school textbooks or in the general political, I mean, they're much more liberal, or in Sweden and in Denmark, but yet you see this kind of discourse and these kinds of parties that, so that goes against, I mean, you know, there is this...
We have an answer to that. We've written a paper on exactly this point. Do you want to do it? But one main differentiation between the radical and the extreme is how they portray national identity, whether they portray it in ethnic terms, therefore blood, race, religion, we are different because we are born different, versus the civic argument, which is we are who we are and we have specific civic education, right? Laïcité in France, for example, parliamentary sovereignty in Britain, and so on. And actually what you will see is that UKIP and the Front National recently, because it's undergoing change, they're not talking about race, we are racially different. They're talking about how parliamentary sovereignty is the better system, or how the EU will take laïcité out of us, and so on. Whereas the Greeks talk about blood traits, which are different. And because we are, from an early age, accustomed to this, it doesn't seem racist in Greece.
Can I just add very quickly, very, very quickly, that on the ethnic civic, I was listening to an SNP MP yesterday talking on TV, and he was saying Scottish nationalism is civic, and he made that distinction and said it's not about where we come from, but it's about where we're going together. So that was his definition, which I think is precisely what you mean. Yeah.
I think obviously he'd read your paper.
I have to respond to this fragmentation because it was a question asked for me as well, right?
Yeah.
I do agree that actually disagree with you because the system was not fragmented before the crisis in Greece, but I'm not sure whether the extreme parties, not just in Greece but also in general, they benefit from the fragmentation of the system as much as they benefit from the fragmentation of the center, the center-right and the center-left, rather. It's interesting that Spain, for instance, sees the fragmentation of its party system right now, but it doesn't see the rise of far-right party. And why do I say the center is very important? Because in this country, what we're seeing is that UKIP is getting voters from, I mean, in the recent elections, they harmed Labour much more than they did Conservative Party. So obviously there are voters in the north of England. They come from, you know, from the Labour Party. And, you know, that's something that also has to kind of, we have to take into account. But in the Greek case, it was everything. It was the system was fragmented. The two-party system was collapsed. So that offered, you know, the fertile ground for this party to rise.
Okay. Before thanking our panellists, can I just mention that the next event that the Hellenic Observatory has is our PhD symposium. One of the things which we're very proud of having is every 2 years we have a symposium of students giving their PhD presentations, students who come from literally around the world. And our next PhD symposium is this year. It's the 7th biennial symposium, and this will be on the 4th and 5th of June, Thursday and Friday, the 4th and 5th of June, here at the LSE. There are public lectures as part of that symposium, as well as individual specialist panels looking at different aspects of Greece and Cyprus. You can get the full information about the PhD symposium on the LSE Hellenic Observatory web pages, and you'd be very welcome to come along. Can I thank my colleagues in the observatory for the organisation and our helpers here this evening. But lastly, let me give a very strong and personal thanks to each of our three speakers. Excellent book, excellent presentation, excellent comments. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much.